Now, everyone knows, and the second one is nurturous abuse of power and self-censorship. Now, everyone knows that you have a constitutional right to that, right? But people are becoming that the government is basically can do anything, you know, and your constitutional rights can be easily ignored. And the bigger problem is that at least the abuse of power is that because of that expensive formulation of the prohibition, right, it can be applied. The application is extremely difficult. You can go basically after everyone. Will that happen? No. But that would give a ground for the government to cherry pick who you go after, right? You have someone in mind and you want to find some legal grounds to detain and let in prison. You use something from that law, and if the person is very very active on the internet or blogging, you can take the guy. Right, so that's why there is this. I think it generates this type of laws are generating, and it would continue to generate the all-watching and all-powerful sense of the government, right? And that would obviously self-censor people a lot, and that's why you don't see, as I have mentioned about, you see different websites and blogs mushrooming in Uzbekistan, right? But there is nothing critical going on because everyone knows, everyone is self-censoring itself or himself or herself because. They know that the government is watching and obviously can use different means to detain you or persecute you, basically. Yeah, and obviously the main attack of the law is on freedom of expression. And if there is no freedom of expression, that there can be no freedom of religion and belief. Yeah, people basically cannot express why they believe in God, why they believe in, I don't know, all the pillars of Islam. Or why they believe in the inherent right of everyone who believes in God or who are Muslims to wear a hijab. So, and in that environment, there's the critical discussion of religious issues, of its relevance to our everyday life is dying. Yeah, is dying. And that's why, I'll come later, there is this hopelessness among people. Why? Because in those websites that I mentioned above, and MSMY refers to the Sheikh, right? Muhammad Sadiq, Muhammad Yusuf. There are just hundreds of questions asking, hey, Sheikh, can I wear a hijab in public places, right? And he says yes. And he says yes. And then he says, we know the cases when the person was tortured or imprisoned just because he was a good Muslim or he was going to the mosque. What we can do? He said, I did my best to bring him out if the person was famous one, and there were several of those. But I cannot do anything more than that. People ask, well, the religion states that, you know, there is, you know, almost unanimous agreement on wearing beard if you are a Muslim, right? And he says, and the government is prohibiting, and he says, yes, the beard is almost obligatory on you, right? So people, on the one side, the scholar is saying that the religion is categorical on those fundamental issues that people think are very important, right? And on the other side, he's admitting that there is little that can be done on the societal level, and that is creating hopelessness. And then if you go to those clips again of Uzbeks who joined ISIS, yeah, they say, well, look at our people in Uzbekistan, right? We say Muslims, but we cannot stand for our ladies, right? Because they are being imprisoned for wearing a hijab and the others, right? So from hopelessness, they are going they are becoming more radicalized, and they are seeking in extreme views, in extreme understanding of Islam as a refuge for their understanding of life, for the values that they think that should be part of their life. And that's eventually, I think, is a threat to secular nature of Uzbekistan. I think Uzbekistan was very right to choose to at least state in the documents. Well, it nowhere it states that Uzbekistan is a secular country. It says it's democratic. But there is general understanding that Uzbekistan is a secular country. And I think Uzbekistan should develop that. But in the absence of open discussion of how Uzbeks, as one of the most religious groups in Central Asia, right, can balance their religious identities with being secular and living in democratic society, we'll see more and more radicalization and developing in Uzbekistan. And because of that pressure on the society, right, I'm seeing development of shortcut Islam, right, as I call it. And that's, you can see in the cell phone applications that I'm friend with people in Uzbekistan, right? You can see they'll be sharing different stories from different Muslim Islamic stories. And some of those are just full of typos. You can see that extremely little person wrote it, right? But everyone is sharing it, saying, oh, look at this story, how beautiful it is about the values of Islam, right? Obviously, there are many stories that you can share on Islamic history and the values it may bring to the society. But those are full of mistakes, and then people are just reading those, and that's the only source of information that they're learning Islam from. And that's developing, and then there are now more and more different Instagram photos, pictures of different things, and then there's a short note from Islam, or saying by a prophet, or a quote from Quran, right, saying this or that. And people would be sharing it over and over again. I would be receiving it many times. The same is happening on the Facebook as well. So there is this now generation that is educating itself only based on this type of shortcut ways of learning Islam, right? And that's why your argument of why you want to be a Muslim in a society does not go beyond those shortcuts, right? And that can be seen in the Charlie Hebdo on the recent cartoon problem in Paris, right? And there was this consistent. You don't have outcry against it, right? Well, I understand it, but because again, well, let me be more clear here. Now, the cartoons came out, right? And there was everyone against that. They were saying, you cannot denigrate our prophet, which is understandable, right? As a Muslim, you can be, humiliated and the others, right? But there was, see, Uzbekistan is more than 30 million population, right? We have lots of scholars. You've seen so many websites on Russia. There was no good article, none. Yeah, that would analyze what has happened in Paris, right? Think what is the Muslim perspective on depicting the Prophet, right? What are the limits of that from Islamic perspective, right? And then it is obviously freedom of expression issue, right? So analyzing that as well, and then balancing that. So how in Uzbekistan, in a Muslim society, you can be a Muslim at the same time, respect and love the Prophet, and at the same time have a, balance that with your secular nature or democratic nature, at least what we claim in Uzbekistan, right? So there was nothing on that. And then that's why, again, that goes back to the shortcut understanding of Islam, and then looking for some other ways of explaining or understanding what is happening around you. Everyone was posting Ramzan Kadyrov, right, Chechen leader, who was saying, we'll have a, 1 million protest to protect them. No one can denigrate the prophet and the others, right? So they are seeking the refuge from those, from that type of positions. But again, there was no this, frank discussion of, how we can understand that. Now, that's on the one part. On the second part, again, because of this closeness of the society, right? People are now seeing in everything conspiracy. Conspiracy about against Muslims, conspiracy about generally Islam, by the Western world, and, generally democracy. Yeah, now people, if you say, during the discussions, I had several discussions with friends on Facebook, and it is amazing how people who I was, considering as educated people, right, who are grown up, and that's the age range would be between 30 to 40, they would be saying, you cannot say this about the Prophet. And I think we have a good, the Tashabbus posted a very good article, although it is in Uzbek only, which analyzes in nice way of the issues that coming up from freedom of expression perspective. And the people would be saying, no, the whole Western world is against Islam, and that's why we are going through this. Sorry. I think I had somewhere. Yeah, so, and then you'll see on the shortcut, you can see West bashing, conspiracy and accusations of double standards, right? I would see, and this type of discussions, and no one was actually asking, so what is freedom of expression, right? What is the democratic society that you live in? What is the Muslim perspective on that? So these are the developments that are coming out from the restrictions. I might have confused you too much with. I should improve the structure, but these are my thoughts about the blogging law in Uzbekistan. I tried to describe the current situation, right? And I think and the implications that are coming out from it. Though there are no direct indications of that, you know, any of these might happen, but it is going on from my observations. That's all I wanted to share today.
Thank you very much, Akmal. Thank you for this extremely interesting presentation, even though I was not extremely optimistic before, but I think I'm even less optimistic now. Your presentation showed very well the restrictions on that internet is facing in Uzbekistan. It goes beyond that by, I mean, showing all the ambiguities in the terminology, in the definition of religion, extremism, or even of religious stress, as you mentioned. And this ambiguity, which is actually voluntarily kept by the government to put pressure on, any kind of opponents or on any kind of religious practices which are not accepted by the government. I will open the floor, but let me maybe ask, if I may, the first question. You were mentioning that after these new laws were passed in September 2014, nobody was really arrested, and even before that, there were no real critical discussions of social political development in Uzbekistan. But my question is, do you feel, when you check now the blogs, the Uzbek blogs, do you feel some consequences of these new amendments, meaning that, for example, do people now refrain even more from blogging than before September 2014. I mean, 4 or 5 months after these new laws. Or do you feel that what people write on these blogs are even a bit more cautious than they were before September 2014? It seems to me, considering what you said, that the rules were already so harsh before that finally it doesn't change so much. I might be wrong, but I would be happy to have your opinion on that.
No, I agree with you. You know, it's the system is already so harsh on any free expression, right? Especially on religious issues. So it is. That's why one of the issues was that to understand the context why the government even adopted it, because the society is already so restricted, right? And what is interesting, you go to any of those websites, right? And if you go down whatever posts they have on their website, right, there's absolutely no comments. And no one leaves a comment, as if either no one is reading it, or everyone is afraid to leave a comment. You know, there is no way everyone agrees with what is written over there, right? And that's amazing, and it's consistent. It's consistent on all the websites that I checked.
Thank you. Yes.
Mine is actually commentary to ask this author. If you don't know me, I'm Delora. I'm also a co-founder of Pleasure Bliss. And after this law passed, I talked to someone who actually was had to talk to SNB, National Security Service people, because of his blogs, his posts, and I promised him not to tell his name so that I can understand it, but there was one case he or she writes mostly on the religion and
Could you just introduce yourself, identify yourself before?
My name is Nikina Valentini, and my interest is in Eurasia, Central Asia particularly, and I focus on evaluations. But my question mostly comes to, you mentioned that there is a decrease of interest in Central Asia, Uzbekistan particularly, from the Western, I guess, media, but also from Uzbek emigres. What do you think is the reason behind it? Just your thoughts.
Thanks. No, I think when I said decrease, I was more referring to Western media and the governments. With regard to emigres, it's just, you know, they lost their relevance for the Uzbeks in Uzbekistan, right? That's why the things they passed, they make very little sense. You know, I personally do not follow any of those, especially their websites. You know, there are the websites separately for different political groups, and I, you know, from time to time I go to them and just to see what they have over there. But because of this long absence from Uzbekistan, the things that they're talking about, they just lost their relevance for Uzbeks, and that's why they're just, you know, getting lost day by day.
And sorry, just to follow up on that question.
Sure. Then,
so while I agree, it can be that they've lost touch because they're not able to go and not in touch with people. But do you think that also that heavy control of the internet by the government also has a role in this, because people are afraid to comment? People are afraid to participate openly in the forums. From what I remember for Ghana, that rule was the last one where the forum was more or less active.
Oh, yeah. No, people are pretty active in Fergana Ru and in Azad League, in Radio Free Europe or BBC Uzbek Service. Well, internet prohibition, you know, different filters, blocking has definitely a role in that. But I think that the substance-wise, I don't know why that's happening, but they just don't have good posts on where to go from now on, right? What to do? They don't have a, you know, feasible, tangible, practical program that they can offer. If they do so, people would still read that, you know, and follow and know somehow from, you know, somewhere. You know, it's still, despite all these blocks on the materials, that there are still ways to let the information go out. Thanks.
Janice Helwig with the U.S. Helsinki Commission. I have lots of questions, but I'll start with one, which is kind of a non-religion question. I can think of one other reason on the timing of this law, which is elections. Because you were just a few months out from parliamentary elections, which then had to be followed 3 months on and soon by presidential elections. So when you talk about the piece of the law that talks about not denigrating people, I just wonder, do you think that could have had an influence on it? And do you see people comment at all on the elections online?
Well, that might be a reason, actually, but I think it is not a strong reason, right? So just look at it from this perspective. We are not even concerned with changing the constitution. Right? We are not talking. So we are having election that and the one candidate is.
I'm wondering this question too.
You would at least change the constitution, right? To give some legitimacy to yourself. Well, you still have 2 months to go, but you know you still have time for that. But there is no discussion of that.
I wondered about it because so far he would be the only one in Central Asia who didn't at least have a parliamentary
previously there were some attempts, but not the last one. Interestingly, but there is discussion, there is discontent, and there is obviously people are saying, well, there are now four candidates, three candidates plus one. Let's put it this way. And everyone is saying, oh, it's just a game. People understand that it is a game, that there is no...
But for the parliamentary, was that the same thing? Because at least you had some local candidates, right? Against each other a little more.
I know at least, yeah. Parliamentary elections, there was good... it was better than the previous ones, we can put it that way. But at the same time, at least I know one person whose husband was very active. Who is a young businessman and did his best to get into the parliament, right? And I'm pretty sure he had a good program. Mm-hmm. He was doing all what is necessary from a healthy democratic outreach and campaign to get as many votes as possible. But he lost, and his wife was so dissatisfied and saying, you know what, this shows again how bad the system is. Basically, the other person, it was obvious that the other person got the votes in a unlawful way. So that's about the parliamentary elections, presidential elections. Well, everyone knows it, you know, despair is still going on, I think. I think journalists might give more perspective on that, but I was not closely, frankly, following that, you know.
What questions? Madam, yes.
Hi, my name is Gillian McCormack. I'm with Internews. That's an NGO that formerly worked in Uzbekistan and is still working in the region. I guess my question to you, apologies if I missed this because I missed the very beginning of your presentation, but I'd be interested. I think your feeling is correct that it's much more about ISIS or controlling religious expression than it is about a response, to, a knee-jerk response to the fact that Russia would introduce legislation. But I'm wondering, you know, whether that is whether they would be justified, the authorities, in really feeling that that this is an actual risk that ISIS could, you know, reach large parts of the population and radicalize them online. I mean, how many people are we actually talking about who use the internet regularly in Uzbekistan? Do you have full mobile phone penetration now? How many people who have a mobile phone are using the internet on their phones? I'm just wondering, is this an actual response to a genuine fear, or is it just maybe another excuse to narrow the sphere of expression?
Can I follow with a similar, almost
Please.
Similar question? So Marlena, GW. Yes, same point on the Islamic State threat. I was wondering, so they are producing all these videos, and we know that some of them has been really watched a lot of time. So clearly that circulates among certain circles. But do you see any kind of just discussion on Facebook or things like that about the fact that there are people going to Syria? I mean, is that part of the general discussion for people who wouldn't be connected to this kind of website? Is that really something that is spreading? Or is that still limited to still very specific circle that would watch this video? And I ask the question because if you compare with Kazakhstan and Tajikistan, where you had people, young people who came back from Syria and who have been arrested and who have been in trial, then jail, and so on, the narrative has changed because during years, all the Kazakh and Tajik narrative, and I mean all the Central Asians narrative, were very much like, oh, the terrorists, they are necessarily foreigners. They can be ours. They are always, so for the Kazakh, they are Uzbek, for the Uzbek, they are Tajik, for the Tajik, they are Afghan. I mean, it's always the other nationality, it's never your own. Local people, but now the narrative, the public narrative in newspaper, official Kazakh and Tajik newspaper, is really much more about they are our kids lost because of course bad things and so on. But it's no more; they are no more considered as foreigner. It's recognized that they are the lost generation, and through the narratives about oh look how in fact they were victims because that's poor people, that's kids with family where there is no father, there's no mother. But at least they are no more foreign; they are. Accepted. So I was wondering if really the Syrian thinks is really changing the framework. I mean, beyond the just the people who would be interested in knowing what is going on there.
No, I don't think in Uzbekistan there is such a recognition of them as ours. They're always, you know, foreign and, you know, training in foreign countries and then joining extremist groups. As to the threats, if there is a genuine threat, well, International Crisis Group just issued a report today, right, and which found that if there is any threat, well, from my reading, it was a quick read today in the morning. Well, if there is any threat of extremism in Central Asia, yeah, that would be because of the repressive policies against basic freedoms, and especially with regard to the freedom of religion. And I agree with that. And, you know, I tried to, you know, partially address that because of these restrictions, obviously they are looking somewhere else. As a last resort to express, to practice, to be a good Muslim, as they think that they should be, right? And then the second one, because of the restrictions of freedom of expression, because they cannot discuss, you know, their daily issues, their struggle with being religious and, you know, living in Uzbekistan, which is assumed to be democratic, right? These type of things make the arguments of extremists stronger. And they are really good in making a you know, argument. They would put several books on their, you know, tables and say, you know, this scholar says this, right? Basically, in this case, we should wage war or, you know, kill the person. And here are the justifications. They are really good with bringing sources and, you know, different scholarship and, you know, theological explanations to that. And because we don't have, you know, this civil or, you know, secular, you know, response to that, or even within the Muslim limits, that is being developed as an immunity to this type of, to the spread of extremist views. Obviously, that the argument of the other side would be stronger. And I think that is one of the things that is, you know, hooking them, basically, as a true religion, as a true understanding of what their religion is, and, you know, drawing them more and more. Yeah.
Questions? Yes.
One more, just about. Hopefully, this will be kind of short. It's about the applicability of the law, and it goes in a little bit to the ISIS question. As I understand the law, and as you presented it, I understand it to apply to people inside Uzbekistan.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be if you were spreading ISIS. I mean, could
not necessarily.
I mean, this law, could the Uzbek government, for example, prosecute an American who posts something on their own Facebook page?
Theoretically, yes. Yeah. Yeah, the law is not limited to Uzbeks only.
It's not limited to inside Uzbekistan.
No.
Because how can an Uzbek law apply internationally?
Well, there are so many questions with the law on how do you do that. And this was actually addressed in the previous event that Marlene and Sebastian organized when we were here with Kathy Cosman, Dilorom, and myself, is the quality of the laws we are producing. It's amazing that how can the parliamentarians sit and come up with those, you know, legal formulations that make absolutely no sense. Absolutely. And again, that gives rise to, you know, vague interpretations, abuse of power by the government, to selective justice. You know, you go after the person if you really want to go after, right? The previous presentation partially was about the religious literature, right? And the law prohibits, you know, anything. And the formatting includes any digital carrier of information. So assume you are coming, let's think of you are coming to Uzbekistan to a conference, right? As a scholar, you have your camera, you have your cell phone, and those have memories, which are, you know, digital carriers of information, right? So if the officer really wants to go after you, the officer can say, you know what, you have digital carrier of information, and I have a right to check if they have some extremist information inside them.
But that's coming into the country.
Correct.
I mean, as opposed to, like,
I'm giving this as an example.
If my commission posted something on our website saying these elections were poorly conducted and, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, the example was given.
what I mean? Yeah. Is the government then supposedly try to open a case against
the U.S.? Yeah. No, this is an example to a poor quality of the laws, right? People are not even thinking about, you know, what can it create?
Because on the internet, it's so global.
It is. And I don't know how they'll be implementing that. That's why there is no, as it was noted, there is no way you can consistently implement the law. You know, it will be only cherry picking. You want to go after someone, there are so many grounds, including legal grounds, to go after them. Actually, you don't even need legal grounds to go after the person. There are so many reasons you can make a case against the person. And it has been consistent with, you know, human rights defenders, with independent journalists. You read their cases. It is just funny what they write. The last one being actually the people were deported from Norway, right? Unfortunately, they were deported. They were accused of Islamic extremism, right? On top of that, they were accused of homosexuality. And that was portrayed on the television. That shows sheer, you know, lawlessness in Uzbekistan, right? To accuse a person in extremism is fine in religious extremism, but on top of that, accuse someone on a homosexual behavior and show it on television, that should, you know, it's the next level of, in a way, stupidity and harshness against, you know, those who take religion seriously. From where to where, but basically, I don't know how the law is being would be implemented. And as I said, you know, again, it will be just someone unfortunate who would be, you know, who the government can go after.